Okay, so I'm now joined by Mr. Paul Clayton. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Martin, here in this strange world that we've all been plunged into, but, you know, hoping.
Who would have thought it would be lasting a year?
I think the thing is probably it's a good thing that nobody told us at the time. So I remember when we were told about 12 weeks, and they said, oh, you people shield for 12 weeks. And I was just thinking that 12 weeks was an incomprehensibly long time to be staying home. And then that sort of, in that first lockdown, we were all rather brilliant and got down to it with blitz spirit and everything until little Dominic decided to go to the optician.
That really did turn everything around, yeah.
Yeah, it broke the trust of an entire country. Yeah. And I think if anybody wants to understand why, at the moment, people don't take any notice of the government, or in my case, with all this news that came out this week, I just go, pinch of salt, large pinch of salt. Because there's a list in one of the papers today of every U-turn or broken date that we've been given. And you just think, if you went to a car salesman or a plumber to do something and they failed or let you down as many times as that has happened in the last year from the government, you wouldn't go near them again.
Yeah, so, absolutely. So how are you keeping your spirit up? Are you working from home a lot? Are you doing like home recordings? And
Way back last year, not long after it started, I did a Doctor Who in my wardrobe. We have a walk-in wardrobe, which turns itself into a recording booth when need be. I did two series of a rather wonderful thing for an American cable channel a couple of years ago, which was the first time I had to do something from home, called Master Porn Theatre.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
It's taken all the acting scenes from 70s and 80s porn films, you know, the bit where the pizza boy knocks on the door and things. And then they wanted the voiceover of an English actor who was obviously treating this very seriously as giving instructions as to, you know, how this was examples of great acting and use of props. And so I used to do that in the wardrobe and send it down the line to New York, and then it came back with amendments. I remember, I'm trying to remember which way round it was, but I remember doing a whole script. They were quite short, mercifully. Doing a whole script, which was called about the use of the double entendre. and it came back with, they like it, brilliant, great, fine, but over here we say double entendre or something. And you thought, typical. Two nations separated by a common language.
So did you have to go back and just re-record that one line? Or
No, I had to re-record every line that had a double entendre in it. so I'd become familiar with the workings of my wardrobe, and I did a Doctor Who for Scott Hancock at Big Finish, and he's brilliant, and he was, and he's also incredibly patient. And but it's that whole thing of getting the input in your ear. And,
yeah, because I guess you're also having to be the sound engineer as well, aren't you, at home?
Well, partly, yeah. I mean, the brilliant thing is that it's just that I've done a few more since then, but now it's actually better because we've now got into using Zoom. So that for voiceovers I've done, I've also had the director on Zoom so they can see what you're doing, and headphones connected to my iPad and Zoom, and then the laptop is dealing with the sound and the mic and everything, and that works. But where possible, I would prefer to go to... I did something else, and they did arrange. We were doing a lot in a day. And I thought, I just want to concentrate on the acting. So I went to a studio that was in the middle of the countryside near Tunbridge Wells, which is about 20 miles away from where I live. And so there was just me and an engineer. And then we were connected to Scott in Cardiff and another actor in London. That meant the technical side was all faultless. But I have done other stuff from home. And on the voice side, and I've written a book.
I was going to bring up your book. I've been reading it, The Punishment. But you're writing a new one, aren't you? Is this a continuation of The Punishment, or is this
No. I think when you get to the end of The Punishment, you'll realise that it might be quite hard to continue.
Okay, I'm only halfway through at the moment.
Okay, well, I hope you're enjoying it.
I am. And one thought I kept having is this would make an excellent TV series.
I know. Itself. Three nights on ITV starring Russell Tovey.
It'd be brilliant.
Yeah, no, The Punisher is great. People love it. And it's a nice page-turning read. And I wrote that in, I think, 2018. And I was prepping another book and then thinking, I was going to France on a writer's retreat at the end of March last year just to start it off. And then lockdown happened. And I thought, well, I suppose I ought to start writing it. And it comes out hopefully on the 1st of April, but certainly the first week of April. It's called The Hoax.
Excellent.
It doesn't take place. There's the big dilemma about whether you write about a corona world or not. And as I was writing very early on, I did mention it. And then when I went back in the edit, I took it out because we didn't know enough. And as to go back to your first point, we didn't know we were still going to be in it a year later. And there was an awful lot of things that just, as I've just done a final check of an edit over the last week, there are a lot of things that couldn't have happened if people were following regulations.
Yeah.
And it's the same with plays and films and things. I just wonder how much we all want to see it or read about it when we've got out of it. We might in a year's time, and we might have great insight about it. And, you know, they're making a film, aren't they, with Ken Branagh playing Boris Johnson.
It's going to be good. I know he's going to be good. But
he's going to be good, yeah. But there's casting above his station. I mean, Boris Johnson could only dream about being played by Kenneth Branagh. You know, Ken Dodd, perhaps. So the story isn't about that. But it is, of course, coloured by some of the things that we've had. So it's about a toxic friendship, really, and about how letting people in as friends, you allow them trust and how it can be broken, and also about this need we seem to have to ask for kindness now. That, you know, during the first lockdown particularly, I remember everybody, you know, BBC London finished their news broadcast every night with, be kind to each other. And you just want to say, piss off.
It shouldn't need to be said, really, should it?
No, you earn my kindness. If you're a friend and you've done something, or by default, I would like to think I am kind. But it can take remarkably little to make me not so. But it is a quality I reserve for people who have a special place in my life, and be they friends or colleagues I respect or my partner. And I think if, you know, we're being told to liberally sprinkle it all around. I mean, why would we be kind to a government who's treated us like this?
That's a good point. There's a difference between being kind and being pleasant. Maybe they should say be pleasant.
It's almost a bit like saying be nice, isn't it? Nice. Terrible.
And it shouldn't need to be said, but yeah.
No, well, it shouldn't need to be said. But also the fact is that, we can't get through, and I really appreciate this. It's very difficult for some people, but you can't get through a sentence on television these days without hearing the word mental health. That comes out of people not treating people, a lot of people, with respect and asking people how you are and looking after people. And to me, that is just something we should intrinsically do.
Yeah.
And then if we're given cause to behave in any other way. But I think people should just say that because people aren't in the room with us at the time they do something that we rabidly disagree with, doesn't mean that we shouldn't be able to state that. You know, we have given ourselves channels whereby we can praise and unfortunately attack people who we've never met at a distance.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you've been an actor, the minute you step out in front of an audience or the camera or as an author, giving that manuscript away and letting people read it and write their reviews on Amazon, you just take it. It's an opinion. And I believe all the good ones, so why shouldn't I believe the bad ones, or vice versa? And it's an opinion. You and I could go to the theatre, we could watch a film, we could listen to an audio together, and some people could think I am really brilliant, and other people from exactly the same performance could think I'm really terrible. I mean, of course, the first group are right, but they're all right because it's an opinion, and it's subjective, so deal with it.
What's your writing process like? Do you set aside a dedicated amount of time each day, or do you just wait until the muse strikes and then you just tap it out?
If I waited for the muse to strike, I'd be a bit like waiting for the 3-5-8 boss here in Kent. No, I was talking to somebody about this yesterday. I'm not brilliant at... I'm very good at working to deadlines. I'm not brilliant at self-motivating. I mean, I have friends who've been writing for years, TV writers and things, and they sit at their desk at 9 a.m. and they write. And when I started writing the 2 non-fiction books I wrote before The Punishment about acting, I thought that's the way I have to do it. And I have to set myself a word target every day. When I came to write The Punishment, I thought, right, okay, I need to write this many words every day, even if they're then crap and you delete some, you sit and do those words. And I, in general, I have dictation software because my typing is shit. But my dictation can quite often be shit as well. I mean, editors have found passages in the middle of books, drafts of books, which talk about the boiler because I happen to turn away and have a conversation and then turn back and the microphone's still on. There is a very funny story in the very first book I wrote about corporate acting, about when dictation software was right at the beginning. This would have been about 1996. And I was demonstrating it with my lovely friend Janet Ellis, and we were doing Good Morning with Pam and Dick for Lotus IBM, a sort of morning television program. And one of the things that we were demonstrating was talk to your computer, voice-activated software. And there was a lovely lady, strangely called Pam, because Janet was also playing somebody called Pam, who sat at a computer on the stage, and she said, you know, dear, help Pam, and this computer typed, and it all came up on a big screen behind us, and it was very wonderful. It took quite a lot of training at that point, but it was great. And on the rehearsals, all day Friday, it was fantastic. And then it was one of those things where you did about 10 shows a day, and it's at an airport hotel on a Saturday. So we came on stage in the morning for 10:30 for the first show, and we're chatting through all the items about how to build your own intranet page. And I sat on the sofa, and Janet went over to Pam and said, so, Pam, you're going to show us something very exciting, in her very best Blue Peter voice. And Pam was a lovely lady from Liverpool who had obviously been training this machine for ages. But in front of an audience, she got that telephone voice syndrome. You know, my mother up in Yorkshire used to have a slightly posh, hello, Robert, whereas she talked like that, really. And so Pam, with the audience there, turned to this computer and started to dictate to it. And I can't remember what it was she said, but as we turned to look at the screen behind us, without a word of a lie, the words anti-Semitic Nazis at Tesco appeared on the screen. So at which point I was a very supportive fellow actor and I just dived behind the sofa to heave my shoulders with laughing. And Janet Ellis, with consummate professionalism, just looked at Pam and said, I don't think that's quite what you said, is it? And poor Pam was distraught and we had to bring the demonstration. But it does, I think it's probably revenge for that moment that my software catches me out, people who get texts and emails that I've dictated very quickly and not checked. So I dictate my 800 words. The great thing is that in lockdown for this book, I've been able to do it when I was walking. So dictaphone, go out, walk around the park, come back, transcribe that, and then edit it. And because this book, The Punishment, was planned, it's based on a true incident. I did, when I was a younger actor, meet a burglar and was asked if I would like to do a bit of burgling. And I said no. It did take me a dinner party to make the decision with some friends. And all the friends, I remember one of them was Sandy Toksvig, and all of us were of the same opinion that it wasn't a moral decision about you shouldn't do it. The thing was, you shouldn't do it if there's any chance you'll be caught. But in the book, obviously, I've explored what happens when he goes off and does take part in a crime. But that was quite plotted out. And the hoax is more, it was sparked by a newspaper story I read about a woman who was deceived in a very elaborate way by her bridesmaid.
Oh.
And I thought, God, I mean, you have to take your hat off to the bridesmaid, the ingenuity. why would you do that? If you hate this woman so much, why not just slap her or something, you know? But I did start telling the story to myself and then turning that into words. And when I'd finished it, there are whole things in it that I hadn't even known were going to be in it. So the great virtue of being able to tell a story and capture it that way is that you do get surprised by what comes out.
Yeah. But you've done a lot of work with Big Finish. And as I said to you on Twitter, I'm a massive fan of Mr. Colchester. So how did you become involved with them?
I got rung up on a Sunday afternoon.
Oh.
I did. My Big Finish career started, about 16, 17 years ago, I think. And I think I was suggested by my agent, and it was Gary Russell when Big Finish was still in a garage or a shed in Stockwell, really. And I went and did something with Colin Baker, and Maria McCurlane and I had an intergalactic nightclub. I never understood it. But it was good fun. Radio is brilliant because you work very quickly and you have to make quite bold choices as an actor. You don't have lots of time for all the thinking about what you're going to do. You do it, and if it's not right, you redo it. So I'd done some, and then I did some things with Scott. I did Dorian Gray, and I did The Infinite Quest once Doctor Who had come back out. Playing a slug who was an arms dealer with my friend Lisa Tarbuck. And then on a Sunday afternoon, it'll be about 4 years ago now, Scott messaged me and said, I want to talk about something. And would you be interested in doing this? And we're putting a new team together for Torchwood. And I didn't really know much about Torchwood. I have to say, I didn't watch it on television. I loved the reboot of Doctor Who, but I didn't really get into it. Not that I didn't get into it. I didn't watch it because when it was on, it wasn't on Saturday nights at 6:30, which was Doctor Who time.
Sure.
I sort of said yes, and they very kindly offered to agree to work around my schedule. And so I turned up in Cardiff for a day to do some photos and to do some scenes. And on that day, I met Johnny and Alex, who it was their first day as well, and they were part of the team and gorgeous. But I have to say, there was a certain amount I didn't really know. And then I travelled back on the train with James Goss, who had written, I think, one of those episodes and was the producer. It was a long train journey, and I learned an awful lot about James, but quite a lot about Torchwood as well. And evidently, they decided to introduce Mr. Colchester as a sort of older gay role model. And I think Russell T. Davis had said they thought he might be Scottish. And Scott had said, let me play you a voice, and evidently played my voice. And Russell went, yeah, if you think that's right, do it. And Russell has said some very nice things, and very kindly, he's a very big St. John Colchester fan.
As am I, and I think a lot of people are. I've seen some of the artwork that people draw on Twitter. So what's it like playing this character? Because he kind of subverts expectation in a way. You think he's going to go one way, and then you find out, obviously, that he's gay and he's married, and he's also tough. Like, he's a real tough guy, and he's a vengeful tough guy. He, like, when he throws that woman off the top of the building, he's like, I slit your wife's throat, just before he throws her off. What's it like playing a character like that?
It's brilliant, because I don't know whether anybody would ever cast me as that on television. I get a right-wing, I suppose, peep show, right-wing dad, and then Graham in Him and Her, you know, slightly quietly spoken gay solicitor. And I do a lot of politicians and things, but I don't think anybody would go action man. I think the great thing about him is exactly what you've said, is that he has the ability to surprise. Mm-hmm. And that you think you know where you are at the beginning in the first episode with this sort of establishment figure who then proceeds to subvert. I mean, that wonderful scene, it is so box ticking, but it's wonderful with Tyler in the cafe where he says, you know, I need to get back to my husband. And there's about two beats from that and something else. And then the next thing is it, he's a Muslim too. And you just think, flawed, you're flawed. So it's great to do that. And the good thing about doing something for a length of time is that somebody had said what Mr. Colchester was, and then you come along as an actor and you read it and you hopefully add something to it. And people hear that, and the writers at Big Finish are very good about listening to it. You know, lovely people like Tim Foley comes to mind because I've met Tim quite a lot in the studio. But then when you get the next set of scripts, you think, there's quite a lot of me in this. Technically, where do we... And you tell people things, and little traits of yourself appear in it. So it becomes more seamless. I made the mistake of telling Scott Hancock that we always have names for our cars. At the time, we had a saloon car called VJ because it was on the registration plate. And I had a little sports car called Rory because his registration began with RAU and he was a bit noisy. And there is a scene where VJ and Rory, it's something to do with dogging, but VJ and Rory get a mention in this. So you have to be really careful around them because they take things.
And you can never drive your car the same way again.
Yeah, they fling them back at you. Say, I don't tell Scott that we've just bought a new car.
You mentioned Him and Her just then. What was that like?
Him and Her was a joy, and it comes down to the same reason that the best scripts work with Big Finish, and the reason that Peep Show was a success is that the writing from Stefan Goluchevsky was just superb, and you don't have to do anything with it. You just have to trust. And added to that, we had a brilliant director called Richard Laxton who wouldn't let you play funny. And I joined to do one episode at the end of season three, which was when Graham would arrive, and it would be obvious to the audience and to Steve and Becky that Graham and Paul, the fabulous Ricky Champ, were something was going on at the gym, but it wouldn't be obvious to Laura. And they'd said to me, come and do this. This character can't come back, but would you come and do it? So I said, yeah, and it was great. And Richard, normally they shot in order, so they shot in sequence. You rehearse the whole episode on a Sunday, and then you shoot each scene in sequence, moving from room to room. So it's a really great way of working, and very detailed. Loved it. They were very, very welcoming. And that's it. Great job. And then the following year, my agent back said, would you like to go back? It's Paul and Laura's wedding, and they want to bring Graham back. And I'm thinking, how's Graham going to... and, of course, this wonderful plotline comes up where it's all about will Paul marry Laura or will he run away with Graham? And the good thing about it was that having got known for, I think, four series at that time we'd done, and then I'd done four series of Peep Show. So Sophie's dad is very gruff and very opinionated. Although Graham was written quite like that, which is, I think, why they got me in at the beginning, Richard just came up with this thing about he's a counsellor, so in his meetings he will obviously be good at speaking, but perhaps when he's in public, perhaps he doesn't really want to be heard. And when a director gives you an interesting dynamic, so rather than booming out going, you know, I'm parked in a disabled bay by the front, I've got a blue badge, he said, you know, anything he says, even if vehement, is very quiet and very... and suddenly, then that wonderful dialogue, you know, I'm parked in a disabled bay around the front, I do have a blue badge, takes on a different dynamic and allows you to go to places that you don't normally go. And the brilliant thing about shooting the wedding was that although we shot out a sequence and shot it like a feature film, we shot for 7 weeks, and... because it was such an ensemble piece, we were all together, and two of the episodes, the wedding ceremony and the speeches, we shot as one take. So we did it 57 times with cameras in different positions, but each time we did a 24-minute take. And, you know, Graham was just doing a lot of texting and looking, but for one take, there'd be one camera right there by you and on focusing on you. So it was really a great piece of work. And also the fact that we were all together in a disused management centre near St Albans, pretending it was a wedding hotel. And you have that wonderful ensemble feel. And we get that a lot in the studio at the Big Finish as well, that there are people you know and you meet up with, and it feeds into the work.
Yeah, that whole series, Him and Her, just feels incredibly realistic. I almost feel like I'm voyeuristic, like I'm looking in on these people's lives, more so than with any other series.
I think that's part of the thing. I think that absolutely comes from... It's also... Because I think if you look back through it, I did then watch the whole series before the first episode I did came out, and, you know, nothing happens. And, of course, then Stefan went on to make three brilliant series of Mum, which was equally sort of nothing really happened, but the things were intensely important. And I think that's quite a key thing. I know now in lockdown, when somebody says, have you had a good week, when we speak to my in-laws on Zoom on a Sunday evening, how's your week? I can't remember, because my week is so full of tiny trivia. But because I haven't been anywhere and got any markers, like I went out for lunch on Wednesday and we went to the theatre on Thursday night, the whole week blends into nothing. So you've done minutiae. Like, I got very excited yesterday because a new pull cord for the bathroom arrived. And I had to get on a stepladder, and that was my event. And by the time I'd done that and then had a cup of tea and a sit down, that was great. The afternoon had gone. And I think that's the sort of ethos behind Him and Her. You recognise and you empathise with the fact that so many of our days are filled with small things that are important to us but don't really have any import to anybody else.
Yeah, that is something I've noticed during lockdown, actually. And I've got a builder coming to do our bathroom on Monday, and that's the event of the month. That is what we're looking forward to, interacting with somebody from outside our household.
No, we went to, of course we didn't do, what I'm now about to say is entirely fictional, but we tested two new cars over the weekend, and we have a second home in Birmingham because my partner runs a company that's based in Birmingham. And it's a flat right in the middle of the city centre in a concierge block. It's very well looked after, but we haven't been there for 3.5 months, and it did need checking on.
Yeah.
So we decided that would be a good excuse for test drive for car one, would be to drive to Birmingham and check the flat.
Hypothetically, of course.
Absolutely. And we did stay overnight, and we came back Saturday morning. And it was a beautiful drive back down the motorway on Saturday morning. And I got back, and I thought, do you know, I never, ever thought I would be so excited by the prospect of a night in Birmingham. And it was like a sort of mini break in Rio de Janeiro.
They should put that on the tourist posters. I never thought I'd be so excited by a night in Birmingham.
I think so, yeah. It was just the driving, and then because the other car we did, we picked up another one on Saturday afternoon, that one, and then we had to be content with driving out to the M25 and down to Sevenoaks and back round and over to Gatwick and back on Sunday and not really go anywhere. But the whole thing of going with a destination and stopping, and all we did was we got straight out of the car, into the flat, checked the flat, stayed in the flat. We brought food from London in a hamper. Yeah. And then on the Saturday morning, get outside, into the car, drive back. And if anybody asks, I'd gone for an eye test.
Well, Dominic did it, so it's fine.
Well, they've all done it. That's the thing. The you know, if Boris has to drive 7 miles to find somewhere where he can go for a bicycle ride, and God knows how many others of them, you can't remember their names, they're all so amorphous.
Yeah.
But
what can we do? Do people quote Sophie's dad at you a lot?
Yes, they do. say if his dad is just in it, because he came in originally for two episodes and that was it. Sam and Jesse said that what they didn't realise was that he was the first adult character that had come into the show who the core audience took to their hearts. And although they'd written him as a sort of, you know, cuckolded monster, people took... people were very sympathetic to him. And, of course, when he did his act of burning the barn in his very first episode, I think he united himself with the viewers, probably who used to watch and not quite see that they were Mark and Jez. Yeah. And so he's very popular. And I was very taken aback when I joined the number of people who would stop you on the street in awe that you were Sophie's dad. Now it's going through a second stage, now that it's out on Netflix, and particularly in lockdown, people have gone mad. And we were in Australia just before the lockdown, the last Christmas, that Christmas, and I can't believe, you know, I got stopped in a vineyard in the Hunter Valley while we were having a picnic, and somebody came over and went, "I'm really sorry, but are you Sophie's dad?" And it's happened in New York, and you think this story of these losers in Croydon or wherever, it's just brilliant that people are, I think it's a credit to the writing and to David and Robert. People love the happy birthday, the Sophie's birthday thing, the Claire Grogan, you know, happy birthday. But I think the line that most people shout at you, or they're proudest that they know, is "I may be a homophobe, but I'm no, I may be a homophobe, Jeremy, but I'm no badger painter." And that is the one that somebody just quoted in the street to me in Sydney, in Australia. And you think, what the fuck? We are how many thousands of miles, and somebody knows that.
It's a good job you remembered the line as well.
I know. I last year I did a Peep Show quiz because Liam Noble, who played Mad Andy, organises them, and they do them at student unions, and they become, all credit to him, he does a brilliant evening. I've been asked to do one. I said, no. And then eventually they said the right number of pounds. And I said, yes. And it was also just pre-lockdown. So I went up the road to somewhere near Goldsmiths in New Cross, and my other half came with me. And we met somebody beforehand, and we went through the question round I was going to ask, and I couldn't. I said, I got about three of them, right? They'd done a round on the Chapman family. And then we went into this room, and I was introduced, and it was absolutely packed to the gills. But there were about 350 people who were just fantastic. But, God, they knew everything. They knew every line. They knew. And, you know, I stayed and did some photos and things with people and hellos. But watching the other rounds and the questions they were asking, the amount of detail, I just couldn't answer this. I couldn't. But, you know, we do things because we want them to be watched. So how nice that something is watched and rewatched and rewatched. And perhaps it's because that in some way it's dealing with a universal truth that there are twats in the world like Mark and Jeremy, and we all have to cope with them.
It's very good, especially where, what is it, 18 years since the first series, and it's still enduring and people are still discovering it. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I know I joined in 2007 in series four. I hadn't really heard of it. And I watched a little bit on YouTube on a Sunday afternoon, and I think I was going in to meet the producers on a Monday morning. And they did have a camera there so that you could work to camera. As always happens, you know, quite often you go for jobs and there are actors who you see quite often who are in your bracket. So there was an actor there, and I thought, yeah, that's who I'd cast. So actually, in a way, that sort of takes the pressure off you because you go in, and I met Robert Popper, the producer, and Becky, who was taking over as director. It was her first series, Becky Martin. And we read, and it was great. And then I thought, fine, that's it. Okay, bye. And then my agent rang and said, they'd like you to do it. Oh, God, okay. So then I did it. It would have been, yeah, beginning of 2007, we filmed series four. And it was great fun, lovely people. You know, having Olivia Colman as your daughter is a treat.
Yeah.
And she was very nice. And I've had the good fortune to have quite a few television children now. And you turn up as somebody's parents. I turned up as Andrew Lancel's father in Coronation Street. And, you know, actually, there's a funny thing that the actors who are your kids sort of feel a responsibility to look after you. So I remember walking onto Coronation Street with Gwen Taylor, who was my wife, and we were both new. And Andrew spent the whole of the first day that we were there filming, you know, looking after us, making sure we got sandwiches. This is where you get your lunch, you know. And Olivia was the same. We had a rehearsal week before we started filming. And on the first day, we were rehearsing episode one, just blocking it out in objectives officers. And she was just like, you know, this is my dad, this is my mum. It was an absolute joy to suddenly become part of. And it's a real treat that it's still around and that a whole new generation of people are enjoying it.
Did you feel like a proud dad on Oscar night?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's probably going to get another one, isn't she, this year, yeah, or whatever it is. But how brilliant. I just think, I think if she were the same age and male, I might be more pissed off. There is a thing about actors that sometimes you grow up, thankfully I've grown out of it, but it is quite hard occasionally when you're out of work, somebody goes like, oh, I've just got this job. And even though it's a job you couldn't possibly have done because you are the wrong gender or the wrong age or the wrong race or whatever, there can be a little niggling thing of, oof, you know. it's the how many actors does it take to change a light bulb, which is evidently six. One to change the light bulb, and five to say, I could have done that. There's an element of that, but there's nothing of that with Olivia. And that's because also she's so gorgeously generous and authentic. What you see is, you know, some people comment that she puts on an act, and actually she doesn't. What she does is she is prepared to step into a situation and not put up her barriers and be as honest as she can be. I'm patron of a children's literacy charity up in my hometown of Rotherham, and when lockdown happened, the kids were all scheduled to do a big poetry day from writing they'd created, and that had to be cancelled. So I said, right, let's do it online. Let's do an online gala. And Olivia was one of the first when I sent out text messages. If I send you a poem written by one of the kids, can you record it on your iPhone and do a video and send it back? And the great thing, of course, is that when you've got Olivia, and we also had Gary Oldman, who's an old mate, it sort of gets quite a lot of interest, which is great for 9 and 10-year-old kids. You know, imagine you're a 9-year-old kid in Rotherham in lockdown, and probably the greatest screen actor in the world, Gary Oldman, reads your poem. Actually, he didn't read it, he sort of acted it. He put a coat on and shivered because it was about being cold. And actually, I know he was doing it in Palm Springs when it was anything but.
Is that for Grimm & Co?
Yeah, Grimm & Co.
Yeah. How did you become involved with them?
Rotherham's my hometown. I spent 10 years as the chairman of the Actors' Centre. One of the things I did was oversee the Alan Bates Award, which was an award given to people leaving drama school. And they used to just get some book tokens and membership of the Actors' Centre. And when you left drama school, I just thought my whole ethos, and it's what my second book was about, is about being a working actor. It's your job. It pays the mortgage. And I just thought that when you come out of drama school, you've had books, you know, you want a nice suit, you know, you quite like them. So we put together a big prize package of an accountancy package, photos. Ted Baker did a makeover for you, and lots of lovely people gave lovely treats that you wouldn't have had. So it was great. And also we instituted a mentorship program for the six finalists. And for the first year that I did that, I mentored the winner, who was an actor called Luke Dale, who came from Sheffield. And I thought that, you know, that could be me. He just finished at Guildhall. And I met his mum at the final. And then I went to see him in something at Guildhall, and I met his mother again. And she told me about this project, because I said, I said, well, actually, I come from just outside Rotherham, a little village outside Rotherham. And she said, oh, that's where, and I I've never seen that in Rotherham. And she said, well, you must come in. And they have created, we're in the process of moving, which has been put on hold over lockdown, but created this magical shop in an old department store that I remember going into as a child and that my mum used to go into when it was a coffee shop, that is the most bizarre, beautiful place. They asked me if I would be patron, one of, I think there are four of us now. I said yes, because I just thought that when I was of an age in Rotherham, there were lots of opportunities. It's not about getting out of Rotherham, but it's about finding opportunities that take you out of yourself and release your imagination.
Sure.
So, you know, on behalf of Rotherham Junior Chamber of Commerce, I won the National Schools Public Speaking Competition when I was 16. And there was a lot of stimulus to be able to do things. And I think there's, although we supposedly care more now, I think there might be slightly less opportunities. And something to me that allowed these kids to come and be in an environment where they could write and treat, were treated as writers, not children, was very important. So I became a patron, and then I thought, what do you do? And what I do is do shows. So a year later, I said, right, we'll do a show and we'll get the kids to write plays and poems and stories. And we nobody had really heard of Grimm & Co. And we took over Barnsley Civic for a night, and lots of actor mates came up from London to be in little 10-minute plays, and people came to read stories and things. And that was a big success. And it was, when you do something, everybody wants to do it again.
Yeah.
So you have to reformat it, because I don't like doing things again. So I said, no, we're not doing another gala. But the following year, we got the kids to write six film scripts, 10-minute films, and then we took them away for 6 months and gave the scripts to 6 individual film companies and said, make the film, would you please? We haven't got any money. Which they did brilliantly. And we had cartoons and stop frame animation and live action. And then the final one of the three was, I happened to just get in when somebody I'd worked with years ago was still commissioning editor for Radio 4. So I went in and went, so the kids have done a stage play and they've done a film, and they haven't done one of the, what I think is the most creative media, which is radio.
Yeah.
So how about a load of kids write afternoon theatre for Radio 4? And bless him, he went, yeah, why not? So they gave us a producer to develop it, and the kids had some workshops about how you write for just voices. Jeremy Dyson, the fourth member of the League of Gentlemen, who's also a patron, did some brilliant stuff on comedy with them. And then they wrote this play. They wrote it in sections, and it was stitched together brilliantly by the kids themselves, working with dramaturgs. And then we took it to Manchester for 3 days with a brilliant cast and recorded it. And it was longlisted for some radio award. I mean, it's a bizarre
thing.
That's
amazing.
I don't know what the listeners of Radio 4 thought about it. My mother-in-law was quite taken with it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And I remember listening to it in my dressing room while I was doing Oldby. I had an hour off after lunch, and so I lay down. It was the most amazing sort of kaleidoscope of sound and bizarre characters meeting. I don't think Radio 4 had ever had anything, but certainly, you know, it was the youngest writers who'd ever written for Radio 4, and it was good that things like that were going out. Well, we haven't been able to do anything else since. We did the online gala last year, and no doubt next year, having just bought a church that we're turning into our new venue, rather than a department store, we'll come up with something hopefully equally creative.
That's incredible. Oh, Paul, I've really enjoyed this. This has been an absolute delight. I could talk to you for all day, but I know you're busy, so I'm going to let you get on. So thank you for joining me today. It's been a real treat for me.
Martin, it's been a pleasure, and thank you for buying The Punishment.
Oh, I'm really enjoying it. Really enjoying it.
And The Hoax is out, I think, early April. I think they're aiming for the 1st of April, which would be the thing, but everything gets a bit slower in Corona world. But it's a joy to talk to you and to meet you. And obviously, I've seen you on Twitter, but it's always great to catch up with somebody.
It's nice to talk to somebody and not have a mask on as well.
Absolutely. Martin, take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Equipment used in the creation of this feature was purchased for a grant from Gray and the Paul Hamlin Foundation.